Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. On this show, we've done a series of interviews focused on breakthrough solutions, talking with people who are helping to create a more just and ecologically sound world. We all know that today's world is not the one we want for ourselves or our children, with climate change, financial insecurity, poverty, and war, including this week, possible military strikes by the U.S. in Syria. But the premise of this show is that we have the solutions we need to create the communities and life we want. We know that another world is not only possible, it is being created now by the actions every day of unsung heroes. Our guest today shares this understanding and knows as much as anybody about those practical solutions. Sarah Van Gelder is the co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and YesMagazine.org, the best source of solutions around. Yes Magazine has been described as something that helps people see the best of what we humans can become and to feel themselves to be agents of change in the unfolding drama of our time. Yes Magazine features powerful ideas and practical actions for building a more just and sustainable world. It covers issues from prison alternatives to climate justice to a cooperative economy. Yes Magazine does such a good job, it recently won the Utney Rita Media Award for General Excellence. In addition to being executive editor of Yes Magazine, Sarah Van Gelder also blogs on the HuffPost about the new economy, climate solutions, alternatives to prison, peacemaking, healthcare, happiness, and more. Sarah lives on a Native American reservation with the Suquamish people, the tribe of Chief Seattle. She joins us from there now. Sarah Van Gelder, welcome to All Together Now.
Eleanor, thank you so much for having me.
What a treat to have you here. You know, you're the editor of Yes Magazine in print and online. You've got your finger on the pulse of what's working. And I would love to know, you know, you helped to start Yes Magazine in 1996. What was it that led you to help start Yes Magazine?
Well, you know, that was back during the Clinton era, and a lot of people would say, you know, that those were the good times. The economy was doing well. We were sort of at peace, not quite, with the incursions into Iraq, but and the sanctions on Iraq. But, you know, a lot of people were doing pretty well. At that time, though, we were already seeing signs that that was unsustainable. We were seeing signs of the environmental decline. I think a lot of other people were, too. We were seeing that, you know, we couldn't keep on adding so much greenhouse gas pollution to our atmosphere and hope to have a good world to leave to our children. We couldn't continue to have such a large gap developing between the haves and the have-nots and have the kind of, you know, middle-class democratic society that I think we all want to have. So we were seeing signs that things were not working, but at the same time, what was really exciting was we were seeing lots of signs that people recognized that and we're working on different aspects of creating a very different kind of world. So we decided our job would be to be the journalists of that new effort that was going on, new enterprise of building a different kind of society. Because once you add some visibility to the extraordinary work that so many people are doing in the grassroots and nationally and internationally, then you give them some visibility, people can see that that other world is possible, and they can see what part they can play in bringing it about. So that's what we set out to do, and 60-some issues of Yes Magazine later, we're still finding all sorts of new areas where people are just doing extraordinary work, and when our readers discover that they're just kind of awestruck that so many other people like them are out there who care about the future of our world.
Fantastic, and you've done a wonderful job at that. I love that, the journalists of a new world. And for our listeners who don't yet know about Yes Magazine, would you please describe what makes Yes different than the vast amount of other media that's out there?
Sure. I would invite readers to check it out themselves. It's all free. We don't have any of those paywalls. It's all free at yesmagazine.org. But what we do is, first of all, we're a nonprofit and ad-free. So we have a business model that's based on the idea that our readers are people who care about the world, and they don't need to be lectured or convinced that things have gone wrong or that they're doing the wrong thing. What they need is access to information and to other people who are doing things that are creative and make a lot of sense. So that's what our editorial purpose is to provide that kind of information to them. And we're also not providing their attention to the highest bidder in the form of advertising. We just have huge respect for their time and you know, the amount of effort it takes to get through, you know, to get the information that they need. And we don't want to put a lot of distracting advertising in their way. So I think that that combination of a focus on what works, on the positive, plus a willingness to be independent from what everybody thinks is a given. You know, everybody thinks that, for example, it's a given that our economy should and couldn't keep on growing. You know, our more empirical question is, you know, can it keep growing given environmental limits? And if we take that seriously, and I think we absolutely have to in this age of climate change, what does it mean? How do we have an economy that actually meets our needs but doesn't undermine the ability of people in the next generation and so on to meet their own needs? What does that mean in practice, in very practical terms? So those are the kinds of questions that we explore. We don't take as for granted the givens of, you know, mainstream corporate journalism. We really question everything and ask what really makes sense for people today and for the next generations to come.
That's fabulous. And I think the fact that you're, you know, free of having to troll around for ads and having to tout the song of the highest bidder gives you that freedom to ask those penetrating questions and to give visibility to things, you know, people who can't afford to pay you to place an ad there, but you'll still cover their work because they're doing good work.
That's absolutely right.
The introduction, I actually was quoting your executive director, Fran Corton, who described ES Magazine as something that helps people see the best of what we humans can become and to feel themselves to be agents of change in the unfolding drama of our time. Do you believe that that's true? And if so, how have you seen that in action?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's our only hope, really, is that instead of just going along with what those in power say we must do, like, for example, that we must go to war in Syria, it's ordinary people who think for themselves and have the right and understand that they have the right as sovereign citizens to make choices in a democratic society. That's where our hope lies. So, you know, I absolutely think that's the case. And, you know, a lot of people feel like they don't have power at the national or international level, but they're doing extraordinary work at a local level. Mm-hmm. That changes our world, too. So it isn't that there is only one place to get involved, that if you don't have a status at the United Nations where you can go in and talk to the delegations in the United Nations, that means you don't have any say. You know, we have enormous amounts of say. Our members of Congress care a lot about what's being said here at the local level. And apart from the decisions that they're making in D.C., there's so many decisions made day by day, you know, in terms of things that protect our water quality or that share resources among people, including the most needy. You know, a lot of those decisions are actually happening at the state and local level. And when we get involved, we can have a huge impact on that. And one other thing is that we can have an impact not only by influencing policymakers, but by the choices that we make every day in our own homes, in how we treat our neighbors, in the kinds of civic organizations that we may choose to start, in the ways that we, you know, we create a kind of an atmosphere in our community that's either based on mutual respect or based on, you know, dismissive and hateful speech. You know, we have choices about those things too. So I do think we ordinary people are the agents of change, and the people who are now the ones in power are so entrenched in the old ways that they really will have a hard time being the leaders of the kinds of shifts we need. I think that kind of leadership is actually coming much more from the grassroots.
Mm-hmm. Right, and here we have in the United States right now President Obama, who was elected on the wave of hope and change, and yet it's him this week who is pushing the country and the Congress to authorize military strikes in Syria. So, you know, sometimes people say, well, it's nice to have visions of another way of being in the world, but, you know, you point out the power that those in the establishment now have, even those who are elected to go in and change it. So if you were advising the president right now, what alternatives to military action would you propose for Syria?
Well, funny you ask, because I'm working on a column on exactly that question right now, and we hope to have it posted by the end of the day today. And, you know, it's a tough question. I work really hard to find the best thinking I could out there. I'm not an expert on Syria, but I know people who are, and I'm very happy to cite them. And here's what I came to after reviewing a lot of different perspectives on this. I think we're at a choice point where we can go down the same old road that we went down when we invaded Iraq or when we invaded Afghanistan. You know, we can go down the road of using the enormously disproportionate military might that the United States has as the way that we interact with the world, that, you know, that we can force our will against people. But to do so would be violating international law, and it would be actually contributing to international lawlessness, because the United Nations Charter, which we've signed, says that you can only attack another country when either you're being attacked or when there's a UN Security Council resolution, and neither of those are present. So we would be violating the law and going almost alone, only with France backing us up. So we would be contributing to international lawlessness. So the column I'm working on right now is saying, what if we took the other route and said, not only won't we personally, you know, we as a nation violate international law, but we're going to work on shoring up the institutions of law so that we can deal with these kinds of criminal acts like the one that resulted in the chemical weapons attacks. We can approach those through the rule of law. We can take those who are guilty to court. We can use rigorous sanctions. We can work with the international community to isolate people who are trying to do that and cut them off from their supplies of arms and other material that they need to go to war. There are all these mechanisms that have been put into place, and they're too weak right now, but we can strengthen those. If the most powerful country in the world said, we are going to make international law work together with the other nations or the community of nations, if we said we were going to make that work, that would have a huge effect on building a more lawful international climate rather than one in which violence is the way that people exert their will.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent approach that you're on there. I find it ironic that President Obama's main rationale for military strikes in Syria is, he said, someone has to defend the rule of law, and the use of chemical weapons is against international law, so therefore we're going to go bomb Syria and degrade their ability to deliver those chemical weapons. So I think you're really hitting right on the weak point of his main argument, is that even though he's claiming that the military strike would be to shore up international law, in fact, as you point out, if the U.S. does this military strike, we would actually be the ones violating international law.
That's right. You know, and it's not like we have to do this attack right now. There are still options at the U.N. Security Council. I know a lot of people are kind of tired of the United Nations, but that is the institution that we have that has legal recourse and that is widely respected around the world. And we still do have options there. We have the option with the UN Security Council of using the International Criminal Court, which is designed to take on questions like this when there's war crimes or crimes against humanity. This is exactly what it was set up to deal with. So when we use lawful and nonviolent means to achieve our end, we're also supporting the institutions that can do that in the future, that can get stronger and be able to take on the despots before they cause 100,000 casualties as has already occurred in Syria.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I'm not sure what problem they think the military strikes is going to solve. It's, you know, we go in there, it's just going to bring the United States military into the mix? I mean, I know they think, well, we'll just do limited strikes and degrade the ability to deliver the chemical weapons. But once you resort to that extreme intervention with military action, you know, we're thrusting the United States in the middle of what's, you know, at this moment, a battle within Syria between the head Assad and then the rebel groups. And it's a big mess over there. It's not even like it's Assad's the bad guy and then you've got the rebel groups wearing the white hats. The rebels themselves are very split and fractured, and some of them are, you know, connected to Al-Qaeda. They're like what the Taliban were in Afghanistan. So, and how are we going to limit what the U.S. involvement is? We think it might be small, but we've been down that road before where we were told it would be limited, but then we end up in a big mess that costs us a lot of treasure and U.S. blood being spilled in the Mideast sand. So I really look forward to reading the article you write on the alternatives to to violence there. It's not like the choice is military strike or no action. The choice can be military strike or nonviolent action, and here's a range of legal steps that the United States could take as a world leader.
That's right, and we actually have six different options that we can take in conjunction with one another or separately. And one of them is to support the nonviolent activists within Syria, who are the ones that initiated the movement back in 2011 to replace the Damascus regime. And those people, you know, when I reference the work of Stephen Zunis, who's a Middle Eastern Studies chairman at the University of San Francisco. And he's done a lot of study about how change happens in a number of countries around the world. And one of the things he says is that the activists who come at this with a nonviolent perspective tend to be the ones that will then set up a government that will also be nonviolent and inclusive. So those are the people you want to support. And those people were overrun by a lot of these violent activists. But if we get involved in a military way, all we do is shore up the violent activists on the opposition side. Then we disempower and we leave in the dust the nonviolent activists within Syria who actually have the best chance of creating the kind of government that I think we'll all want to have in Syria at the end of this period.
Fantastic. Good. Well, I'm eager to read your column. That's going to be on the yesmagazine.org?
It'll be on yesmagazine.org, yes, either today or tomorrow.
Okay, great. As soon as I get it, I think I'll print it out and walk it over to the White House. I'm here in Washington, D.C. today, so I think it'd be important to bring that over to the White House and to Congress, so I'll be watching for that.
You well, know, thank you. That's great.
We want that link. And do you have links in? Is Yes Magazine being read by members of Congress or people in the White House? Or how do we get these great ideas that you've got into the current halls of power?
Well, our best route for doing that is when our readers send our pieces like that to their members of Congress, because people's own constituents seem to pay more attention than if we were to send them ourselves. So we certainly do have members of Congress who read Yes Magazine, but it's when constituents tell their member of Congress or their senator to read this material that we think it has the best chance of getting through.
Yeah, fantastic. Good. So there's a practical action for some of our listeners out there. Get a hold of the Yes Magazine, either in print or online, and bring it over to your member of Congress when they're visiting or send it down to them in D.C. So, Sarah, you know, you've been doing this work courageously, intelligently, thoughtfully, sensitively for 17 years now, and I'm wondering how do you feel about the progress you've made in those 17 years, and after this amount of time, what most excites you about continuing to do this work?
Well, I'm feeling really good about it. There's a lot of things that we were talking about back in the mid-90s that at the time were considered a little bit fringe, you know? I mean, we were talking about local food and other people were, you know, very few other people were looking at that. That was kind of a fringe idea. We were talking about things like, community land trusts and how we can change the way that that the housing market works so that, that poor people don't get displaced and people don't get foreclosed on. And you're talking about people's over-reliance on stuff as a means to get status and happiness. And now a lot more people are talking about these things. So it feels like we've been part of a much broader social movement that has been bringing these kinds of ideas into the mainstream, and they're now far more accepted. So that part's very exciting. Our next step, I mean, we just recently got the funding that enabled us to really ramp up our website. So that's one of the things I'm especially excited about, is how we're bringing much more current ideas onto the website, because our magazine is quarterly. We have a chance once a quarter, just four times a year, to do a really deep dive into some topic, and we bring the very best stories that we can find to our readers through that, you know, long, slow, careful search with our network of people across the United States and around the world. But the website allows us to jump on a topic when it's really timely, like the discussion we just had about Syria. It allows us to draw on the work that we have done over that 17 years. We've accumulated quite an archive and quite a network of expertise to draw on. But it allows us to jump on the stories while they're still current, and that way we're able to get them out through all sorts of other channels. So that's one of the things I'm really excited about right now. And we're just on the verge of starting a brand new project, which is a 2-minute Yes radio spot that we're going to call the Yes Take. And we're going to every week feature a different innovation that we think is making a really big difference. It really matters in the world. And just for 2 minutes, talk about, you know, here's something that we could do. It isn't rocket science. It's just a better way of doing things that this group in Oregon is doing, or this group in New York City is doing, and this is what it looks like. So that's our next innovation. I'm so excited about that.
That sounds great, and I think you're so right when you talk about some of the things that seemed fringe or marginal in the 1990s. People are realizing, hey, you know, we got to take care about the corruption in our food supply. You know, what's in the food that we're eating here? So when we have more of these farmers markets and greater access to local food, we have a better chance of having high-quality food at decent prices, and that helps our health individually, our health of our economy. And so thank you for being in the forefront of some of those ideas that we now are really kind of making some great headway. I'm wondering, on your 2-minute radio spot, where are you going to have that radio spot showing? Do you have your own radio channel, or where would that be placed?
Well, we don't have our own radio channel. Of course, we'll post them on our website at yesmagazine.org. But I also just got off the phone with a community radio station here in Seattle that's very interested, and the Project Censored radio show is also expressed interest, and they have outlets in the Bay Area and San Francisco, in California, and in New York City, and a number of other outlets. So that's where we're starting, and then as we get more practiced, we will we'll also be reaching out to other radio stations.
Fantastic. Well, I want you to know, you know, I've got this radio show with All Together Now, and I love the work that you're doing with Yes Magazine, and love the people that you're profiling, and the interesting creative work that's going on for a more just and sustainable world. So I invite you, if you have people that you're profiling in your magazine or online, let me know, and I'd be happy to interview some of them here on All Together Now.
Oh, that sounds great. Thank you.
Sure. And I'm wondering, you mentioned briefly about some of the issues around stuff. And I know, you know, your magazine usually has a good theme, and your most recent issue was on the human cost of stuff. Can you talk to us a little about this latest issue that you've got on stuff?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. This issue, we've looked at the question of stuff in the past, you know, in terms of the question of, you know, how much do our material possessions really offer us in terms of well-being? Because, you know, advertisers keep selling us on the notion that if we have the right stuff, we will be happy and our friends will admire us and, you know, life will be good. But a lot of people, when they actually try that route, what they find out is that they're then deeply in credit card debt, that they have more stuff than they can actually enjoy, and that it's a big headache to take care of it all. So we've looked at that before, and that has a particular importance right now because all of that stuff has a big ecological impact. You know, we're using up the world's resources, and we're not getting a lot of happiness out of having depleted so many of the world's resources. So this issue took a slightly different turn. This asked a question about the human cost of stuff. Because one of the issues that we're terribly concerned about is human trafficking and sweatshop labor and people who are working many, many hours at such low wages that they're not even able to support a family. So what is it about the way that we treat stuff and expect it to be cheap and expect it to be, you know, maybe disposable that is not only harming the planet but is also creating the wrong kinds of jobs that are in some cases actually literally slave conditions and in other cases resemble slavery conditions. So we wanted to look at alternatives to that. We talked to a woman who had been trafficked herself. She left an extremely low-wage situation to come to the United States to take a job we thought would enable her to support her children who were back home with her grandmother, and instead found herself literally enslaved in a factory where she was not permitted to leave. She was locked in every night. She managed to escape that situation and became a leader in a movement to make sure that other people who are trafficked are not treated that way. So we looked at that, and we looked at what it's been like for a young man who came from Kenya to the United States and how that changed his life, but how it also gave him a deep appreciation for the kind of a life that he had lived back in the village of Kenya where he came from. Even though he didn't have a lot of possessions there, how he had learned to treasure what he did have and to treasure the human relationships that weren't quite as cluttered up by all the stuff that clutters up our life here in the United States. And we looked at things like the cell phone, you know, the smartphones that so many of us enjoy in our lives, but that actually have some pretty serious environmental impacts in terms of the hazardous metals that make them up, that become hazardous when they are not properly recycled, and what it would mean to create a phone that, by design, would be less harmful when it's reached the end of its useful life. So those are some of the questions that we asked in this issue, and this is actually headed up by Krista Hillstrom, who's our web editor, and it's just really delightful to watch another talented member of our team really take some editorial leadership as she did with this issue.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to need to pause now for a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about the issues and stories and people who are helping to create a more just and sustainable world, and also what it's like to live on a Native American reservation. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Sarah Van Gelder, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and YesMagazine.org, the best source of solutions around. Sarah, just before the break, we were talking about your recent issue on stuff. And I'm very curious, in all the years that you've been publishing Yes Magazine, which issue do you think is the most important you've published, and why? Sarah, are you there? We're talking.
Sorry, I was muted.
Oh, okay. Welcome back.
Thanks. I don't know if I can answer that question. That's like asking you to pick among your children.
That very thought occurred to me when I was posing the question, but do you have a feeling for one that, like, if you were to had the chance to go see President Obama and say, well, here's what we do. I produce Yes Magazine. Which magazine issue would you bring?
Okay, well, I don't know if I would actually bring this one, but if this was the one that I could actually get to get through to him, I might bring it, which mm-hmm. is our summer issue called Love and the Apocalypse, Why Radical is the New Normal. And the reason I would bring that is because this one lays out the case that the direction we're going now isn't just a bad idea. It's actually a potentially catastrophic direction. Mm-hmm. You know, the main point there is what the climate scientists tell us will happen if we don't make some really big changes in how we're putting carbon pollution into the atmosphere, that we will reach some tipping point and we won't be able to say, oops, wish we could turn down the heat now, that those tipping points could just take us over the edge into a very catastrophic future. So if there was one issue that I would perhaps show to him, it's this one, because it says, you know what, it's time to let go of those old ways, those sort of, you know, the assumption that we're going to let corporations decide our path for us, that's going to involve perpetual growth and perpetual increases in profits and perpetual increases in the wealth of the 1%, and at the same time that we're going to let the planet get trashed, that whole paradigm has got to change. And this issue lays out some of the most powerful, I think, ways of thinking about radical nonviolent change that is up to the challenge of the moment that we're in. How do we actually take on this level of challenge, given who we are, given our values on nonviolence, given that it has to be a world that works for everybody? And it's doable. That was one of the things that was quite mind-blowing about working on this issue. Just hearing how many brilliant approaches there are, whether it's what's happening in segments of the labor movement that are bringing love into labor organizing, something you might not expect to hear from the way that labor is usually talked about.
Bringing love in, instead of saying,
you know, we're all just going to be adversarial, us against them, is to say, we have to make this work together, and the example that we're particularly focused on in this issue is the workers who work with elderly people and do home health care. That we have to have a solution that works for those frail and vulnerable patients, and we have to have a solution that works for the vulnerable, impoverished, mainly women who take care of them. Mm-hmm. That a solution that works for everybody is possible. And that's what we need to do, is to work together to get that kind of a solution.
Yeah, well, you put your finger on this concern that any aware person has, which is, what are we going to do about climate change? And it feels like, you know, some of the scientists are saying it's too late, we can't stop it, it's already so bad, we're feeling the effects now, and even if we stop total carbon emissions, which is impossible today, then we're still going to be feeling the impact of all the carbon that we've been putting in for many decades. So I'm very encouraged that you're encouraged. And could you tell us, like, what are the best two or three things that we can do to ameliorate or help prevent a catastrophe from the climate change impact?
Well, I guess one of them has to do with the effort that Bill McKibben at 350.org is leading, which is to take on directly the fossil fuel companies that are committed to burning up all that oil that they have in their reserves and that constitutes a lot of their assets, their financial assets, is their belief that they have, that they have the right to burn up all of that carbon. And how do you take them on? Well, the effort that 350.org and other people associated with that movement has to do with divesting from those fossil fuel companies. So that means going to every institution that you have any kind of influence over, and one of those may be colleges, and saying, you know, it's time to divest, just like we did in the area of apartheid in South Africa. time to divest from any company that won't, you know, particularly the fossil fuel companies that won't take on this challenge. We also have a column in a recent, I think it was in the current issue, about how not only students can do this. I mean, students can go to their college and say, you know, you're telling us about the kind of future we're going to have, and you're helping us understand the climate challenge. But at the same time, you're actually investing college money in the big fossil fuel companies. So stop doing that. But it's also something alumni can do. It's not only students that can do that, alumni. So you can go back to your alma mater, who very much wants your contribution, and say, you know what, the next time I make a contribution will be after you have divested from the fossil fuel companies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing you can do. The second has to do with the extreme energy that is now being tapped because the easy fossil fuel is already out and already burned. So some of the extreme examples are removing the tops of mountains to get at the coal, or heating up the sands in Alberta to get the tar sands, and then piping it thousands of miles across the American heartland, including right across the Oglala Aquifer. Or out here in the Northwest, it's building this huge new infrastructure to carry coal from Montana and Wyoming to ocean ports to export to Asia, where it can be burned cheaply, cheaply monetarily, but not so cheaply in terms of the impact on the climate. So in many, many cases, there's also fracking, which some people, because it involves natural gas, some people think it's better for the climate. But the evidence that I've been reading shows that there's enough leakage of methane, which is a very, very potent greenhouse gas, that is actually just as bad for the climate as coal is. So in many, many parts of this country, there is this boom in the wrong kind of energy development. And so wherever we are, there's a good chance that there's some place where we can work on stopping it. And that involves everything from civil disobedience to, you know, showing up at hearings, to lobbying, to, you know, sitting in front of train tracks. So that's the second thing we can do.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's great. That's part of that practical work of what, you know, what can we do to help build a better world, and those are great examples. I want to shift now to ask you about your living situation and the fact that you live on a Native American reservation with the Suquamish tribe, the people of Chief Seattle, and I'm really curious, how did that happen?
Well, it happened just because, in a very casual way, I just found a little cabin that I liked on the reservation, and it was on private land, and I bought the cabin and moved in, and that's where I live today. So I came here not with any particular intent. It just happened to be the neighboring community to the community where Yes is published, which is Bainbridge Island, Washington. So that's how it happened, but it turned out to actually change my life in ways that were completely unexpected. And, you know, I don't know how much of the stories you want to tell, or you want me to tell about that, or...
Well,
you know.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I know any other kind of white person who's living on a Native American reservation, so I can't even imagine how it's changed your life. Just like you do say, it's changed your life in completely unexpected ways. Like, what does that mean for you? Go ahead, tell us that story. How has it changed your life?
Well, I came here not expecting to be particularly involved in the community because frankly, I was pretty busy publishing Yes and raising two children. But shortly after I moved here, one of my neighbors knocked on the door and said, one of my non-Native neighbors, I'm on a street that is almost completely non-Native. The reservation has been what they call checkerboarded, and so many different chunks of the reservation no longer belong to anyone in the tribe or to the tribe itself. So anyway, one of my non-Native neighbors knocked on the door and said, we've got to stop the tribe. They're trying to build housing down the street for their members. And I thought, well, wouldn't that be the most natural thing in the world to happen on a reservation, is that they would build housing for their members? And then I went to a meeting that my neighbors had called, which was intended to pressure the county commission into trying to block this housing project. And I was shocked to find out that there was a huge amount of animosity expressed at that meeting against the tribe. There's just one person after another who got up and said how they would not want those people to be their neighbors. And that was something I had not known anything about, that there was that level of anti-Indian sentiment here right on the reservation. So then I ended up speaking up at that meeting and saying, you know, I think they actually have the right to build housing. And, of course, when settlers first arrived in Seattle, it was the Native people who welcomed them in. And of course, the least that we can do is to facilitate them building homes for their families. Shortly after that, Chief Seattle's grave was desecrated. The cross was pushed over, and a bunch of trash was left on the gravesite, along with articles about this housing project. And I sort of waited for the usual human rights leaders to step up so I could join in a protest about that. But nobody stepped up to say anything. So I got together with my friends, and we called a meeting in the church. And we talked to an elder who I'd met at that first meeting, the one that was so ugly. There had been a tribal elder standing at the back watching the whole thing unfold, and he had thanked me for saying what I said. So I got back in touch with him. And we organized a meeting at the same church of people who wanted to change the way that things were working, who wanted to do something about that level of animosity. And so since then, we formed an organization that was called the Olala Neighbors. Olala is a traditional term for the place where the salt water and the fresh water mix. And it's a place that's particularly productive of the reeds that are used for basket weaving. So that was our name, is the Olala Neighbors, the place where these two different cultures mix and where we can weave things together. And so we've done all these remarkable things that, again, I totally did not expect would happen. But the elder from the tribe that I mentioned, Ted George, has provided us a lot of guidance in what to do. And, you know, a lot of that involved learning ourselves, the non-natives among us, about what the tribal history was and what their culture is about. And where is it exactly that we live? We live on their traditional lands, and what were those ways of life about? And then the biggest thing that we did that was probably the most satisfying was that the home of Chief Seattle is the land on which Chief Seattle actually lived was a state park. Mm. He used to live in this huge longhouse. It was anywhere between the estimates range from 600 to 800 feet long. It was one of the largest, huge cedar longhouses in the whole region. It was a place where people would gather from all over the region. All the other tribes would gather for potlatches. A lot of other families lived there as well. And it had been burned down by the military after Chief Seattle died, because the military was trying to get the Native people to act more like the white settlers and didn't want them living in a longhouse. So the people who were there at that time built a new village in that same place. They built separate houses and schools and churches and everything. Then the military came along and said, no, we need this land for a military fortification. And so they took the entire waterfront from the tribe. And this small area that's now a state park, just to back up, the military didn't ever build a fortification. They sold it to developers who created lots and created summer homes for Seattle tourists. So the tribe lost their entire waterfront, but this very small section of this was preserved by the state and made into a park because the state recognized the historic importance of that land. So fast forward 100 years, and the state was interested in turning that park over to somebody. And they've been having that conversation with the tribe over the years, but every time the same neighbors who had been so antagonistic, about things like the housing project, every time they had objected and said, you know, the non-tribal community does not want that to happen. So this time we were able to come to those same hearings and say, actually, the non-tribal community is very supportive of this happening. We believe this is the only just thing that could happen. Of course they should get this historic land back. And we were able to organize enough people across the state of Washington that the land was, in fact, returned to them in 2004.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So it's just been a wonderful experience. And through all that, I've gotten to know a lot of people and have a lot of friends within the tribe. And this summer, I was actually invited to participate in the annual tribal canoe journey. Every year, all the tribes in the region paddle canoes, often hundreds of miles, to one of the tribes that is hosting that year, This year it was out on the ocean, so I actually was able to paddle with the Squamish Tribe Traditional Canoe Society out to the ocean and take part in these festivities. And,
wow,
and that
that's
was
amazing.
Such an honor. It was such an honor, and it's just one of those sort of life-changing experiences that I'll never forget.
Wow. So were you the only white person on the canoe journey?
No, there are thousands of people there, but they're almost all Native, and usually if somebody is non-Native, it's usually because they've married into the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't the only one, but I was definitely in the minority.
Yeah, well, good for you. What amazing work. That's incredible. So I'm wondering, now that you've had this experience for years, living on the reservation land and working closely with the Native Americans, you know, I'm curious what you think we have to learn from Native Americans today.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people romanticize Native people, and I think, you know, having been their neighbor for this much time, you know, this particular tribe, that everybody's just human. But I think there's some things that indigenous tribes across the world have learned, that the groups of human beings who've been more in the, you know, less rooted in a place, or less, that they have not necessarily remembered. They may have, maybe their ancestors knew it, but maybe they've forgotten it. And some of those are things about the humility of our relationship to Mother Earth and to the natural world that supports us. That, you know, when you soil your nest, you then have to live in a bunch of crap. And, you know, they're such straightforward and common sense lessons that you can imagine that they were learned over the course of history by people who stayed in one place and noticed the impact that they were having and lived with the consequences of it, and then told to their children in the form of stories so that wisdom continued from generation to generation. So a lot of it has to do with that kind of humility about the place that we live and what it means to take care of it and what it means to not assume that those resources will always be there. Mm-hmm. That those are resources that we should be grateful for because they make survival possible, and that we have to take care of the resources if we want them to take care of us. And the other thing that I think is really especially interesting here in the Northwest, which has the potlatch tradition, is there's a whole different way in which you get status and respect. In our culture, you get status still a lot of times by what you have and by your bling and by, you know, if you make the most money. But in this culture, you get status by how much you give away. So on really big occasions, there's a tradition of giving, you know, giving blankets and giving food and giving all sorts of things to everybody you know. And so instead of the chiefs being the most wealthy people, they were often close to the poorest because they were constantly giving everything away to other people. But it also meant that you had a wonderful distribution of wealth because, you know, the widow who's left behind or the person who's, you know, disabled and can't go out fishing themselves, you know, they are likely to be taken care of in the course of this kind of a giving culture.
Mm-hmm. That's really remarkable. It's like going completely the opposite of what Western civilization has been doing for the past couple of centuries.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, I think there is this unfortunate tendency for wealth to accumulate because once in our society, once you have a little bit of wealth and power, you can shift the rules to benefit yourself, which allows you to accumulate even more wealth and power. You know, and back in, you know, the biblical times, there was the call of the Jubilee because farmers were in that same condition. You know, if you plant a crop, you often borrow some money or some resources or some seeds in order to plant your crop, and some years it just doesn't come up very well, and then you're suddenly in debt. And you end up, you know, in some cases going into, you know, selling your children or losing your land and going into debt and becoming even more impoverished. And in the Bible, there is this tradition of the Jubilee, which is that every so often, everything ought to be returned. You know, the children who've been enslaved should be returned to their parents. The land should be returned to the farmer. You know, we need to even things out every once in a while. You end up with these really excesses of huge suffering at the bottom of people who just have nothing and have even lost their children or even lost their freedom, and excess wealth at the top. So every society, it seems to me, has to grapple with this question of what to do with the tendency for wealth to accumulate. And I think it's so interesting that in the traditional society here in the Northwest, the indigenous societies, the way that they found to deal with it is by making, giving away, give the generosity, the most important thing you can do if you're somebody who wants to be respected.
Wow, how do we bring that to Wall Street? I'm ready. I'll finance the bringing of your Yes magazine to Wall Street.
Okay.
When we're talking about that issue, that's fabulous. Well, Sarah, we just have a couple of minutes remaining here, and I so appreciate the great spirit and intelligence and generosity that you bring to the work you do, and the great ideas, great stories that you share so widely and so freely with the rest of us. And I'm wondering, for your own self, you know, what gives you the greatest hope about the future?
Well, it might be, I mean, this is a little of a cliche, but it might be the young people, because I just see them looking at the kind of a crisis that we're facing with really clear eyes. And I actually had a chance to interview a half dozen of them for the Love and the Apocalypse issue I was telling you about, and did a roundtable with them. And I just found they were so clear about understanding the crisis that we're facing, but also the whole range of the personal transformation all the way up through the societal transformation that's necessary. You know, not one of them said, you know, I've got all the answers and I just got to make somebody else do it my way. Each one of them talked about the exploration they have to do within their own lives and within their own selves to transform themselves into being peaceful and respectful and able to work collaboratively with other people, all the way through to how we need to change as a society. So I think there's a remarkable new leadership that's coming up from young people, and you know, I think it's really important to pay attention to the unexpected voices, the people who aren't on the talking head shows, but who just have so much that they're thinking about and so much that they're actually doing to create the kind of a world that I think we all want.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And just before we close here, is there anything else you would like to say to our listeners with like a one-minute close?
Sure. I'd love to ask them to join us at yesmagazine.org and to sign up for our weekly free email newsletter, which will keep them up to date with the newest that we're posting online, and the materials also that they can find in Yes Magazine.
Fantastic. And I do thank you for your great work and encourage our listeners to visit your website, yesmagazine.org, with all the wonderful free information and inspiration that you offer to us all. That's all the time we have. So, Sarah Van Gelder, thank you so much for coming on the program.
And thank you, Eleanor. It's a real treat.
And hopefully more in the future.
Okay.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the Progressive Radio Network archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here with her guest, Elizabeth Dodson Gray, author of a new memoir and several books, including The Great Green Paradise Lost. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with another guest. Thank you for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now. Now that we know.